Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash Burnett.
Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast in association with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes a look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Aaron Gash Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German politics and foreign policy, and I'm here, as always, with my friend and co-host Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. Now, Ben, we're here today actually to talk about, in a way, how to move on from Zeitenwende. The sea change Chancellor Olaf Scholz announced was supposed to happen in German foreign policy after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. Germany has spent the last 2 years reacting, often foot-dragging on military assistance for Ukraine, and seldom leading. And that has had costs in Ukrainian lives, in the hundreds of billions that we were ready to spend to see ourselves through a single winter, and those knock-on budgetary effects domestically. And we could have prevented many of those costs if we were more proactive in the past. And crucially, while Germany might want to hold on to, as you often say, the world of yesterday that it did so well out of, we're not getting any closer to figuring out what world Germany wants for the future. And for that, it would need to go from reactive Zeitenwende to proactive grand strategy, a strategy it doesn't yet have. Luckily for us, though, there's some discussion on this, including in a piece you wrote recently that you can find in our show notes, as well as in contributions our guests today have made on this topic. And we're going to address two central questions, among others. So what kind of grand strategy do we need? And crucially, how do we actually go about finally getting one? But first up, Ben, what exactly is grand strategy and how does it differ from, for example, military strategy?
Well, hello, Aaron, and hello, everyone. Grand strategy is a term and a concept with a very contested history, shrouded in mystery, controversy, and complexity. But actually, in essence, it's really quite straightforward, at least in theory. It's strategic in the way that it's a government chooses to actually get to where it wants to go, to reach a particular objective or desired state. And it's considered grand in two ways, that it encompasses all policy fields, so not just military, as you mentioned. It's not just about how you go about winning a war, for example. It's about a bigger, more overriding and far-reaching goal than that. And as part of that, as you mentioned, it's about having a vision that goes beyond war, for example, to the kind of peace that you would actually like to see, or to the kind of regional or world order that is desired. So something beyond just victory or survival. It's about the kind of world or the kind of region, the kind of society that you want to shape. And so, as I say, in theory, it's quite simple. It's the way that a state can actually marshal its resources and align all the sources of power at its disposal, including its alliances, its diplomatic power, its economic power, and its military might, in the service of achieving a particular mid or long-term objective or vision. But, as I mentioned, despite this ostensible simplicity, good grand strategy is actually a lot more complex. And that's because there's some questions at its heart and some tensions between different ways of doing it. Those we could see in three main terms. One, it's a concept that is contested between different approaches to international relations, for example. So realists might see state strategic decisions largely determined by either human nature, the flawed human nature that they see as conditioning the actions of statespeople and of people more widely, or by the structure of the international system. And realists have tended mainly, though not exclusively, to assign agency in that international system to great powers or major powers. Some have looked at how small states can have grand strategies as well, but by and large, when we talk about grand strategy in historical terms, it's been assigned to larger players.
Empires,
but also great powers of various kinds. So the United States would be a kind of example, Soviet Union, indeed an empire. China today would be seen as actors capable of having a grand strategy. But I have argued elsewhere that others can as well. Liberal approaches to international relations, broadly speaking, tend to prioritize more normative goals rather than this pursuit of power for either survival or primacy. And one example of that could be Woodrow Wilson's famous statement about to make a world safe for democracy, And that would be an example of a leading statement, a description of a grand strategy that led to then the kind of internationalism that Wilson wasn't able to implement, but came to be implemented after the Second World War in the form of liberal internationalism. We could also see there would be post-Cold War grand strategies from the neoconservatives in the US trying to impose democracy by force, trying to iron out the kinks, and they saw it as that hegemonic world of liberal democracy. In other more bloodless forms, perhaps liberalism is focused on institutions and on the possibility for global stability. But these different conceptions also come with other questions about the normative qualities of grand strategy. And that means, can you use it for good or not? Or is it actually necessarily something that will end up with bad outcomes? And that's a discussion that's really big in Germany, because when you hear the term grand strategy in Germany, or when you say the term grand strategy in Germany, a lot of people think it immediately relates back to the bad old ways of doing geopolitics, the kind of geopolitics that the Nazis practiced, the kind of backroom decision-making and deal-making that would be associated with people like Henry Kissinger in the United States. But that's a very one-sided discussion that actually ignores when there have been other types of grand strategy, such as making a world safe for democracy, or, for example, the Reagan administration's use of peace through strength combined with quiet diplomacy in order to be able to actually achieve goals from a position of strength, to be armed to the teeth but ready to talk. And that was the grand strategy that many have argued actually helped bring about an end to the Cold War, ramping up the costs of competition militarily for the Soviets, so hollowing out their economy from within, but at the same time actually removing some of the danger from the nuclear confrontation in Europe and around the world by being willing to talk, engaging in this quiet diplomacy from a position of strength. So there's different views on the normative quality of grand strategy, whether it can be a force for good or whether it necessarily leads you down a bad track. And last, I think the elements that are contested within grand strategy are who it's for, who it's against, and who it's made by, and how that is made. And I've alluded to this a little bit before, but understanding whether this is an action of the state for an abstract concept of the state, is it for the national interest, or is it something broader? Is this actually something that the whole of society can benefit from? Who is it against? Is it against adversaries? Do we want to have those kind of adversarial relationships? Is that necessary to actually face down the kind of threats that you would see to achieving your grand strategic vision? Or is that setting up a friend-enemy relation that's going to take you in a bad way? Again, different views on that. Again, with whom? So is it with allies, or is it actually to the detriment of your allies? And all those questions are things that we've tried to address in the new working group on grand strategy that I set up at the German Council on Foreign Relations, the DGAP, which has been working since September last year. And you can read more about that in the show notes, as you say. But we also wanted to get into a discussion about that with some real experts, two of whom are part of the grand strategy group, Eileen Matley and Jakob Ross, and with a renowned German grand strategist, Maximilian Ter Haller.
Yes, absolutely, Ben. And before we welcome our guests here, you know, as you've been saying, you know, in this country, the word grand strategy comes with assumptions about that it's somehow nefarious. But as you've been saying, of course, it's not good or bad to have a strategy. It is how you use that strategy that makes it good or bad. And we must always remember that, you know, our adversaries, the world's authoritarians, they always have a strategy. So that's why we have to discuss having one ourselves as democracies.
Exactly right. This is not a time when democracies can afford to be strategilos or without a strategy, because there are clear strategic actors aligned against us and working against our interests as well as against our values. And it's been that lack of a compelling strategy that has actually undermined Germany's foreign policy in a case in point, but also the West's approach to international relations more widely in the last 10 to 15 years, when previous grand strategies ran out of steam and when we started to get into a bit of a strategic confusion. And you can argue about whether that's a confusion over the goals or a confusion over the means to achieve them. So is it about the vision or the strategy itself? Is it a deficit that comes from not having a strategy, or is it a deficit from having bad strategy? And that's what we're going to talk about with our guests today.
And joining us to talk about grand strategic vision today, we have Maximilian Ter Haller, a professor of strategic studies at the London School of Economics and former advisor to the UK Ministry of Defence. He has literally written the book on the new strategic culture Germany needs. The book is called The Responsibility to Defend, and you can find the info you need on that in the show notes. Also joining us, I'm pleased to say, are two returning guests to Berlin Side Out. Eileen Matla is a research fellow in the Council's Center on Security and Defense, who appeared on our third episode covering German defense. And finally, we have Jakob Ross, also a Council research fellow focusing on Franco-German relations, who first appeared on our Franco-German episode with French author Sylvie Kaufmann. Welcome to the show, everyone. Max, let's start with you. NATO's first Secretary General, Lord Ismay, famously described NATO's purpose as keep the Soviet Union out, the US in, and the Germans down. Now, you've argued that purpose should be reimagined to keep the US in, the Russians out, and the Chinese in check. First, how significant is that keep the Germans down line doesn't appear in that new reimagining you argue for? And second, so far, I personally see resolute German commitment to only one of those three new goals, which is to keep the US in. What is Germany's role in this new NATO, and how do we get there?
Indeed, I tried to rephrase the pattern put out some 75 years ago. I would say that, you know, keeping the Americans in is absolute key, however difficult that is. I would stress keeping the Russians down. It would have been a much more appropriate way of putting it, and keeping the Chinese in check, if not more, is fundamental. And why am I saying that? I do see that these two major powers, and major in the sense that they have the material power to disrupt, and a fundamentally clear understanding on behalf of Russia to disrupt the Western order, if you like, in Europe and beyond, and that these two powers have in many ways linked up their efforts to disrupt the Western order to a very, very high standard already. So in that sense, the question was, how would you address that? Germany needs to revisit and refine its own understanding of membership at NATO, NATO as the key alliance that brought Germany back into life after World War II, and that instead of a more passive understanding of membership, where Germany has certainly done its duties during the Cold War, but now needs to pick up and see that this alliance is the bedrock of its own security and of the security of Europe. And for that to work, Germany needs to be proactive, taking the initiative and underlying it with substantive material power in order to face off those that want to disrupt the order from which Germany has benefited more than anybody else in Europe.
I think this quote, this famous quote about keeping the Germans down, is often a little misunderstood. I mean, it's at its heart, it sounds terrible, but at its heart, what it is a balance of power argument to stop an overmighty Germany rising in its geostrategically significant position in Europe and disrupting the European order. So that was what the idea behind it was, after seeing the rising Germany as a challenging power, a revisionist power, having caused two world wars within 30 years. And so that was the logic behind that. As well as this, you mentioned that NATO actually was a way for Germany to rise up, to rise from the ashes of World War II and from its crimes that it committed. But in order to do that, as you mentioned, it had to contribute. And to contribute, there had to be a clear rationale for this. And that's where I think grand strategy comes into this equation, because Germany's contribution to NATO was part of its process of Westbindung, or West integration, reintegration with the West. So could you say a little bit more about that and why? I mean, you've written in your book, Responsibility to Defend, that the position of equidistance, for example, between two other blocs, between the US and between China, would not provide a suitable grand strategy for Germany today.
Two points I'd like to make. One is more historical, the other one straightforward, strategic. So first, the historical one. I think a fundamental problem in all of the discussions that we have had about the so-called mindset that needs to change in our thinking, which when I look at core parts of the government, I don't see much of change. But the fundamental point here is really to look at our own history, no longer as we've done for good reasons, as a negative foil against which we can only say never again, but to flip this foil around and say, yes, never again, of course, but that's no longer the point. The point is to turn this legacy into a proactive action and to see what aggressive revisionist powers are up to and how you take them on in order to stop them from what they're doing. So in that sense, I would say Germans are, and I'm not ironic here, better prepared than anybody else to understand what revisionist powers are about. Now, so that's the first more historic philosophical point, but I think it would help to flip the mindset into the right direction. The second, about the contribution, again, if driven by an understanding that such a contribution is fundamental to Germany's own security and well-being, and therefore Germany needs to take on a leadership position within NATO, I think is core. The notion of equidistance is a bit remote, but it has had a very lively appearance in the German debates, and I think it should be completely off the table. So it's very clear who is against and who is for us. In that sense, that's what war is about. The enemy is clear. The enemy is Russia. It is also very clear, despite the recent visit of Charles Scholz in China, what China is doing to support Russia in all kinds that hybrid warfare allows it to do. And in that sense, there can be no equidistance. There should be much more, especially in regard to China, much more inventive thinking as to how Germany can start decoupling from China.
Jakob Ross, we've talked about grand strategy a lot at the DGAP in our grand strategy group. Is there really that clarity in German decision-making? Has the war brought the necessary clarity? Or is there still actually a strategic confusion, in your view, about how to deal with these adversarial powers, Russia and China, as well as how to deal with Germany's allies?
I would say that there is still a lot of confusion. I agree with what Max said, that the direction at least has become clear since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, where we have to go. But there's a sense, and I feel this very much since I remember my days in university, that this is a generational task to get to a level of strategic thinking in Germany, to discuss geopolitics in a way that has been normal in other countries. Say France, the country I'm very familiar with, is not the case in Germany, and it will not happen overnight. It will take at least a generation to shift the mindset. And the confusion is still very clear with regards to Russia. I think in Germany, you still have a separated country to a certain degree. You have Eastern Germany that is much less clear with regards to the Russian threat. We will see that in the elections in several federal states at the end of the year in Germany, where both the AfD on the extreme right and extreme left parties have a much clearer stance towards Russia and are polling very well currently. So I think it's not that clear, at least in parts of the country. And the same is true for China. The German economy is very much intermingled with the Chinese economy. Big German corporations, car manufacturers, the chemistry industry, machine builders are very much dependent on the Chinese market. I mean, most of our children today are on TikTok and nobody is really controlling that. So I think that the clear separation is much more difficult today than it used to be, probably in the Cold War. I mean, just the economic links that still exist towards Russia, the French who are buying uranium, there's still imports going out of Russia. We are still selling parts, or at least machinery that is built by German companies ends up in Russia. So the clear-cut line is much harder to get in a globalized economy. Germany was indeed the country that profited most from this opening up of economies, globalization. But today we have to get back to these interconnections and have a critical look on each and every one of them, not only Russia and China.
It's not just the Germany's children, it's Germany's chancellor who's on TikTok. But I would push back a little bit on the notion that it was less complex in the old days, the good old days when everything was simple, cut and clear. We actually had to make it simple. The kind of things that COCOM restrictions on trade with the Eastern Bloc, with the Soviet and Soviet satellite states imposed on Western companies and were enforced was driven by a clear geopolitical agenda. And this is where we see the need for a grand strategy, is that it does act as that lodestar for policymaking across different fields. So not only in building up military strength, in contributing, as Maximilian Tahala said, to NATO's force posture and force availability, but actually understanding that companies play a role in that, that private trade cannot be allowed to undermine national positioning. I don't think it was necessarily as cut and dried in the Cold War as sometimes people make it out to be, but we were able to actually have a policy that cohered because we had that strategic vision. Now, Eileen, I'd like to come to you on that in terms of how Germany's current strategic positioning manifests itself in the defense realm and in practical defense matters.
Thank you, Ben. I am not as pessimistic about Germany's role in NATO as Maximilian, to be honest. I do agree that Germany has to do much more. Germany has to raise, first of all, its defense budget in order to enable itself to do more. However, I don't see Germany having a passive understanding of its role in NATO at all. Why do I say that? Firstly, starting in 2014, Germany did step up its game compared to what it did before. I'm not saying that necessarily compares to what was necessary, but it definitely compared to what it did before. With the beginning of Russia's attack on Ukraine in 2014, Germany was actually key in coming up in conceptual terms, but also in its practical implementation of the Readiness Action Plan, which was NATO's first reaction to Russia's attack on Ukraine, dating back to 2014. For example, Germany not only, as I said, came up with the concept, but it also was a lead nation in providing troops and also leading the BJTF, the Very High Readiness Joint Force that was also created in 2014. Following up on that, Germany agreed in 2016 to become a lead nation or a framework nation in Lithuania, together with Canada, together with the UK and the US and the three Baltic states and Poland. Now, we've also seen dramatic shifts, compared to what Germany did before since 2022. Let's not forget that Germany offered to dispatch an entire brigade to Lithuania. I also understand that there was quite a bit of confusion between the both countries, between Lithuania and Germany, as to how that should materialize. And initially, Germany only wanted to assign a brigade stationed on German soil to the defense of Lithuania. But then, as we all know, last year, the German defense minister stepped forward and offered to dispatch the entire brigade to Lithuanian soil. That's a first in Germany's history. And it's by no means clear yet whether Germany will succeed in that endeavor. However, claiming that Germany doesn't have any understanding of what it is doing in NATO and also its role in NATO, I would strongly object to.
I think it's the key distinction that we need to make is between what the head of governments are doing and what they're thinking and what the organization does and offers to the alliance. So between the entire years of the Merkel years, remember the Krim annexation in 2014, the big uproar in Berlin and the Munich Security Conference, where everybody agreed that everything had to change. All these things were going on. here and there, bits and pieces. Even the white paper in 2016 spoke of, for the first time, of Landes- und Bündnisverteidigung. But all of this had been pulverized, really, by Ms. Merkel following the track of Minsk, not willing to pay 2% throughout her entire time as the chancellor. And so all I'm saying is that there was a massive tension between what the bureaucracy, the organization, the military did in terms of the bits and pieces that were possible. But all of this was literally defeated in the mind of Putin in terms of credibility of deterrence, that he nonetheless invaded what he wanted to invade, regardless of the steps that you correctly mentioned. As a move forward, it didn't change at all Putin's thinking. The bottom line here is Merkel sent throughout her time in office the message that deterrence was not the number one term on her mindset.
This rather points to that strategic deficit, or either in terms of not having a grand strategy or in terms of having a very poor strategy, because all those steps that Eileen, you mentioned, they ended up becoming less than the sum of their parts, because they weren't actually coherent, they weren't consistent across policy fields. And for all the positive steps you mentioned, even if it still wasn't enough, even if it still wasn't meeting the 2% target, etc., they were undermined by doing things like signing the Nord Stream 2 agreement with Russia after the annexation of Crimea. And that, again, I think points to this strategic lack that was there, or certainly strategic ambiguity in perhaps the worst sense, strategic confusion that was dominating German policymaking there. Now, Jakob, coming to this historical point, why has Germany found that so difficult in recent times to avow an overt strategic positioning?
Well, I mean, as we discussed at DJP and in the piece we published on grand strategy and the problems that might come with it in public debate, and especially with regards to German history, is that Germany's experience with grand strategy, with geopolitics, with these grand designs, is one of great suffering that Germany brought to the world, especially to its European neighbors. Something that developed to a certain degree in Germany. The Munich School of Geopolitics is a very specific way to see the world. And I can very well remember studying international politics in Germany at German universities that, you know, you couldn't discuss geopolitics. At times, maybe in classes on geography, and then it was critical geopolitics, but you always had to approach it in a certain way. And there was no classes to approach strategic questions in a way as has been normal once again in the US, in Britain, in France, in other allied states. I think that's changing. There's now new university programs, including at the University of Bonn. Maximilian might also witness to the fact that these questions have been discussed at the universities of the Bundeswehr already, but not in a manner like in other countries, that generations of students get introduced to these concepts, can discuss them in a critical way. That's an important part of grand strategy, of a vivid debate outside of expert circles. But this is something that definitely lacks in Germany, and it's mainly due to the controversial parts of geopolitics, the entanglement with the Nazi regime in the 1930s, 1940s, concepts like Lebensraum. But I think that there has to be more discussions on geopolitics. And if they are critical, well, that's a good thing that Germany might be able to bring to the debate, where, say, France is not critical enough of its use of grand designs, grand strategy in the past, and might not be critical enough going forward.
I think our history has essentially almost deceived us into thinking that we are past geopolitics, we are above geopolitics, we are post strategic discussion, and that we can have a world that is absent strategy. I mean, we talked about Nord Stream 2 just a second ago. And for a long, long, long time, German elites pretended that this was a purely commercial project, when, of course, Central and East Europeans and Ukraine said that it wasn't. It had a strategic and geopolitical implication that we simply refuse to see. And sometimes I actually wonder whether our refusal to really consider de-risking versus decoupling in China is repeating this exact same mistake. We're just not repeating it with the Russians, we're repeating it with the Chinese. Grand strategy is more than a military strategy. And as the title of your piece goes on grand strategy, Ben, Germany needs a strategy grand and democratic, but part of having a democratic grand strategy is recognizing that you are, in fact, in a world of systemic competition between democracies and authoritarian states, that everything comes into play, not just military questions, but also economic ones. And those authoritarians certainly see us as adversaries. Putin clearly already thinks Russia is at war with NATO, even if Olaf Scholz and Joe Biden don't want to admit it. And while we might not have a strategy, our adversaries certainly do. Yet neither our public nor our elites really seem to understand the need for strategy. I mean, how do we actually change this strategic discussion? What sort of concrete steps do you start taking?
I've worked on grand strategic questions for a very long time, and I do see the necessity to translate governmental thinking into coherent thinking, drawing together conceptually and then materially all resources that a state has in order to bring together, to maximize its power. Now, the question is, of course, to which purpose? And that goes back to what Aaron hinted at. It's the perception. You know, what kind of perception of our international environment do we have? Do we perceive, as Ms. Merkel has did a long time, Russia not as an enemy, but as someone that's difficult, but we can deal with without understanding the long-term intentions? And there's a legacy in that thinking also in the current government. So coherence in terms of drawing together and drawing on all resources possible, but fundamental is to any strategic thinking, a clear perception of your environment. And if you don't have a strategic view which sees, which recognizes the need to identify potential enemies as such as they are, as good as they are at deceiving and veiling their intentions, the whole strategic debate falls flat. And that's something we're clearly lacking. It's a war where someone wants to bring down an entire order. And the only thing that matters really is to have a very clear understanding of what the intention is, talking about perception, and then go against it full in.
Talking about NATO, I think this problem is not as big, since NATO was indeed founded against a clear enemy with a clear purpose. But I mean, in Germany, you have to take into account other structures. You know, the European Union, for instance, was not found against anything. It was found to integrate the continent. It was basically a peace project. So I think that's part of the discussion in Germany, in other both EU and NATO member states. How to find a good balance between those objectives, you know, integrating a continent and then developing a clear-cut strategy against a threat to this continent. And that's absolutely not clear to me. I mean, many important states, partner states of Germany, France, first and foremost, are still trying to get an autonomous European answer, autonomous from the United States, autonomous from NATO. I mean, even though France might have shifted and might be more present on NATO's eastern flank, more conscious about the Russian threat, more engaged in supporting Eastern European member states of both NATO and the European Union. In terms of the long-term objectives, if we are talking about grand strategy, this idea of European autonomy in a transatlantic world where the United States are drifting towards the Pacific is definitely something that has to be taken into account as well. And I think it's not going to go away, and it very much impacts the discussions in Germany as well.
I largely do agree that most Germans, including the highest ranks in the current government, do like a strategic vision, or to put it, you know, differently, on the flip side, they suffer from a sort of strategic confusion. most of them. I would not agree that it applies to all members of the government. I wouldn't agree that it applies to all members of our parliament. And I would like to bring in the first ever formulated and published national security strategy that was last year put out by the German government. And I would say, in sum, it does not live up to the expectations that probably most have or had when they heard that Germany was working on such a document. I do agree that it is really it's a bit underwhelming in terms of actually coming up with a strategy, because for a strategy, as you know, we all know and has been mentioned before, you need a clear-cut goal. However, I think there are some bits that we can work with. For example, I think what the government is most clear about is actually the threat emanating from Russia. In the strategy, in the document, it very clearly states that Russia is the most single threat that the Euro-Atlantic area is facing today. And that is actually almost the very same language that the new strategic concept of NATO has used in 2022. I think there's still room for improvement. It is a bit of a missed chance. It could have been much more clear in terms of prioritizing, because I think that is also the task of coming up with a strategy to prioritize, to say, okay, this is our most important goal and this is how we're going about reaching that goal. That is something that the strategy is missing, because it reads a bit like a laundry list of, you know, everything is important, but in order to call a document a strategy, you must prioritize. And that is something that you can't, in my view, find in that document. And that is also missing in other debates following the discussions in Berlin.
Going back to our understanding of the strategic mindset that's missing, everybody talks about strategic nowadays. But how do you prioritize your priorities? How do you do that? Well, if everything is important, which you define as priority, then you have a whole list of 2 pages and everything seems to be important. And what do governments do? Well, they work them down and up the ladder based on the so-called and perceived time pressure, but not based on the strategic importance of the individual issues. I think that's a point totally lost in the NSS. And again, I would stress, we need to distinguish between what the apparatuses do and think and what they agree on, and what leading decision makers think and do. These are two things. So when it was mentioned that indeed Russia is called a threat, it's not so much talk about China here. What is this threat really about? How do you think about this threat? Threat is a very, very broad term that can be used, and it's not prioritized as to what that implies. And the second thing is now, underlining what I've said now a couple of times, the distinction between leaders and apparatuses. Read the foreword by Scholz. That's the essential summary of what he thinks is important, and what he leaves out doesn't seem to be that important. I don't see a broad and clear-cut understanding of what is the German vision for Europe's security order in the next 5 years and what that means. There's little debate as to what the future of the transatlantic relationship should look like. There's, however, much talk about the so-called Global South. All of this is left largely open, but there's no clear-cut understanding of what is the key priority and why.
It does well at providing a framework for outlining the challenges that Germany faces, sure. But it doesn't address how we actually allocate resources, but also how we coordinate strategy between government, between business, between civil society. So there doesn't seem to also be, you know, a strategy to even get other groups of society to buy into the strategy, right? So how do we actually get everyone on board, especially if we look at one particular part of German society that might be missing the memo, large parts of German business, when we have the CEO of Mercedes-Benz Benz, saying that their version of de-risking is to actually increase their presence in China and thus our dependence. How do we actually get everyone on board, even with the strategy and the goal in general?
I think it's indicative that there is nothing that you could say about that strategy or about the government's positioning that would equate to something like Westbindung or peace through strength or something where you would have this very clear vision that could be encapsulated in just a few words. Instead, what you get is integrated security, which is actually a description of what a strategy should include rather than being a goal for that strategy itself. So you have a fundamental confusion at its heart. Then you have two different visions included in the national security, one of a more multipolar world and one of systemic competition, which gives you a muddle from the beginning there. But I would argue that there is something else going on with that. And what Max just said about what's included and what's not, I think you can draw out quite a bit from, because I think the strategy that is underlying this, that is unspoken in a way, is this submerged equidistance, this submerged multipolarity that is actually underlying a lot of what is driving current government policy, which is a way of rescuing as much of this flat world of globalization from which Germany did very well as possible and translating it into the new geopolitical environment. So it's a strategy, and this is where I think the Zeitenwende equates a little bit to that wonderful moment in Il Gatto Pardo, the leopard, where the speech is made, says, for everything to stay the same, everything must change. And so you get this idea of keeping continuity dressed up in a language of change. And that is what I think is underlying. But this is not something that is avowed publicly. So it doesn't have that strategic galvanizing effect that Aaron just mentioned of drawing different actors together around a unifying theme, nor can it really act as a lodestar for policymaking. Instead, what you get is the devolved policymaking of the China strategy. We leave it up to business. Now, what it doesn't do is give you a clear change in direction.
Also, I mean, fundamentally, because it's the same people implementing the change that have been in office for a very long time. You know, I mean, if you have people like Frank-Walter Steinmeier at the federal presidency, Christoph Heusgen now heading the Munich Security Conference, I mean, these were the people that came up with the strategies of the past that clearly did not work and now implement the sea change. It could work, I mean, surely, but there's no change, generational change of ideas or personnel fundamentally in Berlin. I mean, it's basically the same people still in power positions implementing the change that were responsible for the lack of strategy in the past.
Yes, there are people who have been in powerful positions throughout the last couple of years and even decades in some cases. However, you also have Annalena Baerbock, you have Christian Lindner, who at least, and Robert Habeck, who are not part of the government in the past couple of years and decades, informing the ideas or the lack of vision that we've been talking about and criticizing for the past half hour now. I think it's a bit too easy to just, or a bit too simplistic to say everyone in the German government, everyone in Germany is lacking a clear vision of where Germany needs to go in terms of its security and defense policies, or even, you know, when talking about a grand strategy where obviously not only these two policy fields are affected and should be involved. I think there are actually, especially when you look at the Green Party voices and even in the FDP, voices who are more clear-cut about the threat that Russia is presenting. Let's just go back a couple of years when during the election campaign in 2021, Baerbock was the only one who, when asked about Nord Stream 2, said, well, yeah, obviously it is not a commercial project, it is a geopolitical project. So I'd like to object the notion that everyone in Germany is confused about where Germany needs to go and what we need to do about it. In general, and I understand it's not Annalena Baerbock and or Robert Habeck or Christian Lindner leading the chancellery, I understand that most of the decision-making is made at the chancellery by Olaf Scholz. I don't object to that. Which also leads to the observation, I believe, that we are lacking a bit of a strategic vision. What to do about that? Several proposals that have been discussed in the last couple of years. For example, the establishment of a National Security Council that was heavily debated also in the run-up to the publication of the National Security Strategy. I think it was a missed chance to come up with that coordinating body. I don't think that it's just a sort of top-down process, but also a bottom-up process that needs to be kicked off in order to get Germany to a place where we do not struggle to discuss the topics that we've been discussing now. So I think it should be a two-pronged approach where the government, where governing bodies lead the way, but at the same time also leave room for civil society to be involved in those discussions. However, I think we should also bear in mind where we came from and compared to where we came from, to what Germany did or didn't do until 2022 in most parts, I think we have come a long way. Is there still a lot to do? Yeah, of course there is. But again, I would see the Haas rather, half full than half empty.
Often when I hear the debates in Berlin, and not just in the Berlin bubble, but in ministries and elsewhere, I often wonder, does that mean that Germany is setting the time frame within which decisions can or cannot be made? There's often a belief if we come up with a new force posture for Bundeswehr or with a new national security strategy or something else, within which we've laid out for how long it will take to implement it, this sends the implication that we are in charge of setting the time frame within which all of this is happening. No, it's not. Remember how extremely surprised people were on the 24th of February 2022. Why? Because someone had not taken into account the German reading of history, but had fundamentally disrupted on its own terms what he wanted to do. So I just want to throw some cold water on our belief that as long as we spend enough time on identifying our way forward, which then we will implement in good course, then most things will fall into line. I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding as to what threats are around us and how we measure these threats, because they're not going to wait for us to get ready, or should I say battle ready.
Indeed, this hubristic notion that somehow the world adapts to Germany's parliamentary schedule has been thoroughly debunked, but at the same time still seems to be adhered to.
Absolutely. However, there are also signs, in my understanding, pointing to the contrary. For example, Defense Minister Pistorius, together with other defense ministers in Europe, has gone out of his way, has gone on the record saying that we have a time window of about 5 to 7, maybe 8 years until Russia might be able to have reassembled its forces in order to start an attack on NATO territory. And I think that is a very specific timeline we're talking about. Whether that is accurate or not is a different discussion. I also hear from colleagues in Central and Eastern Europe that time window is much shorter. But regardless, I think we do see changes. They might not be as happening as quickly as we would like them to.
Just so that we don't fall into the trap of German self-introspection. We've talked a lot about Germany and what it can do, what constraints are and all that.
I'm remembering back to what we were discussing earlier about the national security strategy. It was very clear about Russia's role as a threat to German and European security. But I'd like to push back on this a little bit, because it's not entirely clear that even though this isn't a strategic document and it's a stated understanding that Russia is a threat, that this is really entirely appreciated in terms of how the government, in particular the chancellery, is actually acting towards the Russian threat at the moment. We're discussing a new chapter in German grand strategy at a time when French strategic arguments are shifting, rhetorically at least, and we seem to be seeing a French president who is more willing to argue his Bratislava agenda of increased support for Ukraine along with Central and Eastern Europe and the UK, at a time when Berlin and Washington are drip-feeding weapons to Ukraine and not explicitly backing Ukrainian victory. And Max and Ben, you spearheaded an open letter, which basically said that this was dangerous, that this strategic understanding that Olaf Scholz appeared to have towards how to win the war in Ukraine was just simply not there. And Macron has been much more explicit about the need to support Ukraine towards victory as opposed to simply a stalemate. Can this rift in strategy be mended between France and Germany? And then the last thing is, it's fine for Germany to say that Russia is a threat in some strategic document, but is it really acting that way?
Is the grass really always greener elsewhere? Are others actually getting this right?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to see in France that they are surprisingly having the same problems with shifting their grand strategic approach, if you will, as the Germans do. Macron, surprisingly to many, since the speech in Bratislava, seems to be willing to do much more in a NATO framework, to send more soldiers to the eastern flank. The French aircraft carrier strike group just came under NATO command yesterday for the first time in history. So these are indeed strong signals. But Macron is fighting the same bureaucratic inertia and the entrenched culture in its own country than Olaf Scholz or anybody else trying to implement Zeitenwende in Germany. You know, large parts of the French officer corps are pretty pro-Russian. They don't see the Russian threat as much as many in Germany might, or even more so on NATO's eastern flank. Many in the French command structures have been raised in a culture that was very much focused on the Pacific, on Western Africa, on the Grand Large, as the French say, so French role in the world. So it's very, very difficult to bring these people to focus on the threat in Russia, on territorial defense, allied defense in NATO's realm. So no, I don't think the grass is greener in France, but I think it's a good sign, again, that this process that we are going through in Germany with Zeitenwende is indeed something that is needed and done in other countries too. So, I mean, Germany might be less exceptional in that sense than we in Berlin tend to think, with the big difference, again, coming back to this European Union-NATO relationship, that Emmanuel Macron, when he stepped on the international stage in 2017, came with a grand strategic vision, to my mind. I mean, he talked about European strategic autonomy since 2017. And that, to my mind, is this kind of grand objective, long-term objective that people can work towards, that people can concentrate resources on, be it militarily, economically, with regards to supply chains. But this objective is now very much in contradiction with what we see happening in Europe. I mean, what I see, at least from a German or Franco-German perspective, is more of the emergence of a NATO Europe. So NATO being much more important, especially for states on the eastern flank, but also for others. The British coming back into many of these discussions despite Brexit. So it's not at all the European Union that is taking the lead in these discussions. And so that's running contrary to the geostrategic vision that President Macron came into office with, and he now has to adapt. And I think to this point, it's still very difficult to say if it's indeed a long-term strategic change that we are seeing with France, or if it's just a tactical reaction, and if Macron might go back to European strategic autonomy and try to break out of this formula of a European pillar within NATO as soon as he can.
Max, let's turn to you on this about other countries and how they're going through this, other strategic cultures. And I mean, we might argue indeed there are many strategic deficits. There's a German strategic deficit with German characteristics, but what are the strategic deficits elsewhere, or how are others actually approaching this, and are they doing any better?
What is fundamental in terms of how to read a country's strategic culture is whether or not you can decipher an instinct about what a country would fight for. Where is the, to use the much overused term, red line for a country from a strategic point of view? What is it that a country would fight for? When I say fight for, I don't just mean when would they pick up the weapons and march, but underlying this is then the grand strategic understanding of how to observe the world or one's environment while we're still in peacetime, or these preparations during peacetime about which nobody needs to talk much. That is, I think, the should be the ingrained language of grand strategic thinking, that you have to be prepared for war in order to prevent it. And that is the grand strategic notion, really, at its best, to be constantly aware that even though you may have gotten used to a European socialization and that the world around you is peaceful, but what is happening outside this world, and that you are ready to engage with such thinking, putting up a different hat, a different kind of rationality as to how and as to what others want to achieve, often not with means that we're used to in Brussels and elsewhere. And to get that drilled into our understanding of strategic culture is fundamentally important in order to survive in the world we live in.
Jakob has pointed out rightly earlier that it usually takes a generation to build a strategic culture, to build a strategic mindset. So if that were true, I think we're talking about time frames of 10, 15, 20, or maybe even 25 years, if in peacetime. I think that calculation could change very quickly if indeed we were no longer in a sort of gray zone that we are in right now between peace and war, but we're faced with an actual war, which obviously nobody hopes for, but still, I think that could really dramatically change the situation that we are in today. And I mean, there are empirical data you can point to, which would suggest that the majority of Germans do understand that Russia is indeed a very, if not the most significant threat that Germany is faced with. However, the problem always then is when it comes to practical means. What does that mean? What do we derive from that? And then the picture becomes a bit more murky. It becomes a bit less clear when we're talking about practical means, right? For example, you know, were Germans ready to actually fight Russia? Were Germany to agree to have Bundeswehr soldiers that are stationed in Lithuania now or on other parts of the eastern flank be willing to fight off a Russian attack? I think it's a bit too early to tell. I've been traveling throughout Germany and engaging in public debates with like the larger public for the past 2 years. And my sense is that compared to prior 2022, there is more openness to understand that we are living in a different world now. I mean, arguably, you know, that world existed already, you know, much earlier and, you know, prior to 2022. But how can you expect a population to understand the threats they are facing if their political elites are not raising the alarm bells or making the right announcements backed up by the right decisions? We here at DJAP are also engaging in that public outreach with, you know, an event series that you, Ben, started with your team, Zeitenwende vor deiner Tür. And I think those are the exact measures that not only members of parliament or other officials should engage in, but also civil societies, actors, and experts like ourselves. And I think, I mean, sometimes those discussions will not, you know, end the way that we would like them to, and there might be controversies, but let's not shy away from that, because that's what a democracy is about, to make sure that the best argument wins.
Eileen, thank you so much, and also for the plug. And you will be appearing at our Zeitenwende vor deiner Tür event in Waren on Thursday, the 18th of April, and Maximilian Terhalla will be joining us the night before in Magdeburg for a discussion of the Zeitenwende. So, yes, picking up on that and drawing it together a little bit, we've talked in our group before that there is a contested field of views about strategy in Germany. There has been, as Eileen mentioned, that if political leaders are not making the case for this clearly enough, it will be difficult for people to follow. But we also know there are groups actively resisting this as well. And there's been an anti-strategic culture also in public debate.
I would very much agree with what Eileen just said. I think that it's an important part of think tanking, of working in expert communities to bring the discussions we are having to the largest audience possible out there through podcasts, through panel discussions, through public events. I think that's a very important first step. I think that many more people in Germany should be discussing foreign policy, security policy. A second step, very important as well, is to give more resources to research at universities, I think, to break these the impression that talking about military affairs, about war, is something to be stigmatized at universities, to be kept out of civil universities. That's a big problem in Germany, at least to my mind. And comparing it, once again, I know the French example, comparing it to other countries. And then I think it's also scrutiny. I mean, I would wish for a federal election campaign coming up next year that would make for a good competition between foreign policy viewpoints, between grand strategic designs. I would very much like, for instance, the opposition, the biggest opposition party, the CDU in Germany, taking this topic and bringing it into these elections and telling the public, okay, we had the announcement of Chancellor Scholz in February 2022 of a Zeitenwende. Here we are now. That's how we want to pursue this. That's how we want to make it different. That's how we want to do it better. And then the SPD could react. The Greens would certainly react. And I'm certainly biased since I'm working on these questions on a daily basis, but I think it would do the country tremendously good to make this a central topic for the electoral campaign in 2025.
And that's something we could help along the way. We could offer to host the debate exactly on what are the competing strategic visions and the strategies to get there from different parties, challenge them to come up with it, or then, you know, accuse them of being strategilos if they fail to actually deliver. Max, what's your take on this? And what are the obstacles we need to overcome in German public and expert discourse to actually get to that better strategic culture that we would all like to see?
There's a, to all of this, since we live in civil societies and democracies, there's a top-down and a bottom-up approach. The top-down approach has been largely and powerfully shaped by the core understandings of the leading governmental party, which runs the chancellery. The SPD has succeeded against the Greens and the Liberals in many instances. Look at Taurus, look at the National Security Council, and other instances where it's simply clear that the SPD is the ruling party. Now, together with that comes a clear understanding of Scholz and others, not Pistorius, who have communicated in Parliament and elsewhere, particularly recently about Taurus. And I don't want to go into Taurus, but it's a much broader issue that came up during the debate about Taurus, when Scholz attacked one member of the opposition, saying, you are instilling fear into people. People will become fearful when they hear you. And these are powerful tools of public communication that are also very short-sighted, you know, because it seems that the leadership only addresses a single member of parliament when the whole world is listening to what the German Chancellor is saying. So the top-down approach is very clearly shaped by the governmental, the ruling party, and has set the tone for many debates by suggesting, I am the one who will take care of the fact that there's no escalation, you don't need to be fearful. That sets the tone for, say, ordinary citizens for them. This is a guiding line when the Chancellor says this is dangerous, this is creating fear and all sorts of, people would say, okay, then this must be a valid point. Bottom up, I would agree with Jacob, there's a lot of new thinking going on that has not yet fully materialized. There are initiatives to come up with new professorships and so on and so forth. But looking back, the years between, let's say, 2014 and 22 were years in which key leaders in public debates did not press forward and demand for a more strategic view, in the sense that who is our enemy? Who is willing and aiming to literally disrupt and possibly destroy later the European order from which we've benefited so much? I've experienced much pushback. We're not going to talk much about that. It was not only me, it was many others who tried to raise the points, and they were seriously pushed back because there was a common understanding, a common view, a common worldview, which was based on the win-win globalization understanding, the flat world that you mentioned, where it was absolutely inconceivable that someone would go ahead and disrupt this world. As Merkel still said in 2019, 22, anybody who goes back to Machtpolitik, power politics, will defeat himself. Well, not everybody saw it that way. And that is the kind of thinking where I had wished that powerful think tanks, powerful public figures would have said, right, we would like to invite you to a stern public debate in our think tank or elsewhere. And we would like to have a frank discussion where you can expose the underlying assumptions of your thinking and then justify them against criticism. That's what I've seen throughout the world, be it in America and in Britain and elsewhere, Singapore. That's what needs to be done, not by making public leaders look foolish, but by exposing the underlying assumptions, what you called, Ben, earlier, which is actually a term used in strategic studies, what are the unspoken assumptions of leaders? That is something that you will not find in the national security strategy, but you will find it in, say emotionally raised debates in the Bundestag, when people really come up with what they think and why they think the way they think. That is important. I think that we need more professional debates where key leaders are invited, don't just give their speech and leave, but then are questioned by serious and well-educated think tankers, strategically educated think tankers, who then can ask powerful, piercing questions in order to get to the heart of the issue. And that, I think, was lacking definitely between 2014 and 22. What is the purpose of our strategy, instead of, which you can often see, wrangling about numbers, maybe a bit here, maybe though, and that. That's not the point. That is strategy on a low level, but grand strategy works on a different level. And that tells you where the country wants to take itself. Otherwise, it will be taken by others into the opposite direction.
That's it. And this is a point we often make on the show, is to say the goal defines the means. If you're stuck talking about the means with no clear goal, then you're not actually doing strategy in any serious sense. And I think to pick up on what you said before, Max and Jakob, interrogating those spoken assumptions, but also the unspoken assumptions, the stated preferences and the revealed preferences that come through different forms of acting and speaking is an essential part of this. And instead of that, what exactly you mentioned before, the accusation is thrown back of fear-mongering, of scaremongering, of warmongering, when we should be actually talking about these potential consequences of different courses of action, which would then lead us to be able to properly interrogate those assumptions upon which either an implicit or explicit strategy is being formulated or implemented in practice. And I think that's what's been lacking to a big degree in a lot of the German debate, which is quite particular for that reason, because not only has the analysis been questioned, the analysis of actually seeing threats is questioned at its fundamental level for then, quote unquote, securitizing certain issues, for eliminating them from the discussion of normal politics. And we see that as a discussion across so-called critical security studies in many fields and many countries. But also here, then, the assumption that the remedy to that of having proper strategy is also part of the problem comes out. And so that resistance to strategy itself, because it smacks of those bad old ways of geopolitics that you both mentioned before, which resonate in Germany in a different way than they do elsewhere. But I think what we identified also is that there are strategic cultures and different strategic traditions in other countries that don't suffer from that problem, but they do suffer from those problems of limited backroom decision-making. They suffer from lack of inclusion of various perspectives that could make a genuinely democratic grand strategy. And I think it's important to make it democratic in that way if we're going to actually have it as a clear goal for the democratic world. That's been such an interesting discussion on grand strategy, its particular context in Germany and the difficulties of creating new grand strategy here, but also much widely, more widely applicable issues that go to other countries, other democracies as well, who are struggling to find the right approach to deal with our authoritarian challenges, while also trying to create an inclusive world order that nonetheless serves the interests and values of democracies. And I think one thing that it's really important to point out is that if this is going to catch on in Germany, it does seem as though a more inclusive, democratically based grand strategy would have to be the way that that's done. And so that puts the onus on elected politicians and on experts who are active in the public realm to really engage with these questions. And as Max Terhalla said, interrogate some of the underlying assumptions, the unspoken assumptions that undergird the performance of strategy, the conceptualization of strategy, either when it's explicitly announced or when it's being practiced without giving it a name. And that kind of exercise, I think, will help us a lot in addressing the strategic deficit that either by lack of strategy or by bad strategy still plagues the German response to a rapidly changing world.
And as we've been discussing, I probably would simply add that it starts with us simply realizing and also appreciating and acknowledging that any choice we make has a strategic implication. So, you know, it's not that we can simply, you know, sit out these kinds of decisions or pretend that they don't have strategic implications. We were talking about Nord Stream 2 earlier. That had a strategic implication, even though German policymakers at the time wanted to pretend that it was purely a commercial project. If we talk about support for Ukraine, I mean, there's some members of our political elite who might think that they can just duck certain questions, but on what kind of weapons to send, how many, that sort of thing. But even deciding what to send or not, you know, is indeed a strategic choice. Whether we seize Russia's state assets to transfer over to Ukraine is a strategic choice. I mean, we can't pretend that if we don't do it, that we don't set a precedent for what happens when a country you know, commits violations of international law the way that Russia has. Choosing not to act is also a strategic choice. You know, if there's always a choice.
That's right. And certainly all these choices have strategic implications and they affect your strategic positioning. What's missing is a clearly announced or clearly enunciated vision which could act as a lodestar for policymaking against which such decisions could then be evaluated, such choices could be made in a way that's coherent across those different policy fields. And as we heard in relation to France as well, that would be an issue that comes up at the moment too. So while talking tough on Russia, while backing that up with quite a bit of military saber rattling, France is continuing to buy hundreds of millions of euros of Russian liquid natural gas. So that doesn't speak to strategic coherence. And so actually putting these things a bit more front and center in decision making would allow us to hold policymakers to account. Now, whether they want that is a different question. But in a democracy, that's exactly what we should be doing. And we have the right to do it at the level of the strategic as well as the level of domestic policy.
Well, to close out, I would just say there's a reason the title of your article is Strategy Grand and Democratic. So I think that final point is particularly salient. That's all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Join us in the next weeks as we take a look back at the historical influences over German foreign policy. Before we get into what victory takes in Ukraine and for the democratic West, of which Germany is a part, Thank you to our guests today, Maximilian Terhala, Eileen Madler, and Jakob Ross, and also to our project assistant, Julian Stuckler, our technical producer, Hendrik Vanna, and the DJP team. Once more from Berlin, Auf Wiedersehen and Tschüss.